kryptonite, a green mineral that makes Superman ill, and you've got the essentials covered. But these are just dots on a timeline. It's the job of writers and artists to join them. What was Krypton like? Why did Jor-El send his son to Earth? What did the Kents teach young Clark? What was it like to gain such power at an early age, to be so different from your peers? How did it feel for Clark to learn about his alien heritage, the destruction of Krypton? What was the rationale for keeping his abilities a secret? Why does he feel responsible for helping human beings when he's not one? What drew Clark to journalism? What does Lois see in the Man of Steel? What made Lex so hateful and insecure? How did humanity react to the arrival of Superman? Did they immediately embrace him as the hero he claimed to be? Or were they concerned, confused, scared? Every era of Superman tries to answer some of these questions. New writers draw from their predecessors, but also invent new details and motivations. Only the bullet points are canonical. The rest is open for interpretation. Siegel and Shuster didn't concern themselves with the interior life of Superman. After their one-page backstory, it's straight into feats of strength and derring do, which is what their mostly young audience wanted. Later, as comics readers got older, plots and characters grew more sophisticated. We still want Superman to punch monsters, of course, but we also want a little more psychological and emotional authenticity, as much as that's possible, anyway, in a world where superheroes fight monsters for the fate of the multiverse monthly. In trying to achieve this authenticity, modern writers of long-running superhero titles face a common problem. The bullet points of the hero's backstory were created in an era when psychological reality wasn't important. On one hand, you have an audience that demands deeper takes on classic characters. On the other, you have narrative frameworks that didn't account for deepness, but which cannot be altered in fundamental ways at penalty of death from fans and the hero's corporate owners. Modern writers have to work backward from iconic but hastily conceived origin stories. They have to find ways to join the dots that offer something more than feats of super strength. This is easier for some superheroes than others. Take Batman, whose backstory we're just as familiar with. A young Bruce Wayne witnesses the murder of his parents by a petty thief in Gotham City, then vows to avenge their deaths by fighting crime. To strike fear into the hearts of criminals, a superstitious and cowardly lot, he takes on the likeness of a bat. As with Action Comics number 1, Batman creators Bob Kane and Bill Finger cover the origin story in nearly a single page, and the essential points haven't changed in 80 years. Despite that, Batman still resonates with modern audiences, and writers have found a number of compelling ways to enrich the psychology of the character within the boundaries of a decades-old narrative skeleton. That's because the Batman origin was psychologically and emotionally rich from the start. At the heart of the character is trauma, the murder of his parents. Bruce Wayne decides to become Batman as an act of vengeance. He's a man obsessed. That obsession drives him, but it also prevents him from processing the trauma in a healthier way. Writers have mined this precarious mental state for lots of good drama. Every time Batman ventures into Gotham City's underworld, it's as if he's descending into his own tortured psyche. In his villains, we see his personal demons never letting him rest. Tormented antiheroes fit the modern sensibility. We like our heroes flawed and our villains sympathetic. Maybe that's because we've witnessed too much messy reality to buy pure goodness. Maybe it's because pure goodness is boring. Maybe it's because the conflict that really captivates us is not physical, but internal. When new writers tackle old heroes, we want them to ground the character's choices so they make sense to us today, but we also want to see them struggle with those choices, as we do with ours. The character of Batman lends itself to that. What about Superman? Does the Boy Scout in blue tights, the tireless defender of truth, justice, and the American way, fit the modern sensibility? Not in the way Batman does, that's for sure. We can sympathize with someone's parents being killed, but can we sympathize with someone's alien home planet exploding? We can relate to a man risking death to avenge his loved ones, but can we relate to an invincible being who protects the entire world? We can empathize with a crusader, but what about a Man of Steel? I think we can empathize with Superman, but it's harder to pull off. In many ways, the man of tomorrow is a relic of values past. He's a symbol of that goodness we no longer recognize in the world. He's the epitome of the classic hero the anti-hero was invented to modernize. His idealism smacks of naivete, and in the comics, he's regularly mocked for this by other heroes, especially Batman. This is why many consider Superman a boring character. He's too perfect, too powerful, too vanilla. Even his creators thought so, which is why they invented Kryptonite, his Achilles heel. As far as vulnerabilities go, Kryptonite is not the most creative. It's little more than a narrative device in physical form, and a blunt one at that. If internal conflict is what makes a character interesting, Kryptonite does the opposite for Superman. It externalizes vulnerability. It's a cheap way for weaker villains to gain an upper hand. But I can see why its inventors felt it necessary. All of Superman's villains are weaker than him. To remedy this imbalance, DC Comics has tried to depower Superman a few times throughout the years. In the early 70s, for example, Dennis O'Neil wrote an arc where Superman fights an alien doppelganger made out of sand who permanently depletes his powers by a third. The idea was to pit Supes against more modest foes instead of having him constantly face cosmic threats. But fans weren't interested in a weaker Superman, so DC abandoned this new direction after a year and restored their hero to full strength. The first issue after O'Neil left the comic begins, hilariously, trillions of miles out in deep galactic space. Then he survives a supernova. In 1986, John Byrne rebooted the character and pared back his powers again. He could no longer move planets, and a mere 40-megaton bomb left him unconscious for a half hour. Supernovas were clearly out of the question. Byrne's version lasted longer than O'Neil's, but eventually Superman's powers crept back up. In the subsequent decades, his strength has ebbed and flowed. When, for some wacky reason or other, Superman's powers vanish or decrease significantly, it's usually cited as an opportunity to humanize the character, which implies that Superman is always at risk of becoming unrelatable. And he is. It's hard to get Superman right. It's hard to make any Golden Age hero relevant to a modern reader, but it's especially hard with Superman. Depowering him is one way to do it, but it's not the only way. There are terrific stories in which Supes is fully powered and fully relatable, and there are dull stories where he gets a bloody lip. I don't think you humanize Superman by focusing on the physical. He is too perfect in that respect. But just because he's perfect physically doesn't mean he's perfect in every way. Superman is not without psychological weaknesses. He's not invulnerable to emotion. This, I think, is what writers should focus on. Bob Prohl said, "The best Superman is whichever one you were reading when you were 12. The Superman I encountered at 12 wasn't Superman. My introduction to the character was through the TV series Smallville, about an adolescent Clark Kent. This was 2001, before the superhero film craze began in earnest. Today, the general public knows a startling amount about comics universes. My mom just asked me not to spoil a show about the Scarlet Witch. In 2001, I knew as little as most people. I was aware of Superman and Batman, of course, but none of the history, none of the lore. The whiff of that lore in Smallville is what piqued my interest. In a move that Hollywood has now perfected, Smallville drew on a feeling of intertextuality to interest people in the show. The Superman mythos churned beneath the surface, and part of the fun was seeing how they referenced it. The tagline said it all. Every story has a beginning. We knew what the ending would be. Clark would become Superman. He started the show with just a few powers, ignorant of his alien heritage, and unfamiliar with anyone called Lex Luthor or Lois Lane. So when Lex accidentally runs into Clark with his car in the series premiere and they become friends, or when he's shocked by a sudden ability to see through solid objects, we as the knowing audience get a little jolt. His nemesis, X-ray vision. These days, we're oversaturated with moments like this. But 2 decades ago, it was thrilling to a 13-year-old me. I needed to know more, so I started reading comics. I lost myself in the lore, and that's how I became a true superfan. That's the last time I'll use that term, promise. But if the intertextuality is what hooked me, it wasn't the reason I kept watching. Those little jolts are exciting, but they're not substantial, the equivalent of sugar rushes. The real substance of any good drama is character. Internal conflict, relationships, events that explore what it means to be human. Now, I'm not saying Smallville was The Wire or Breaking Bad. As Jeopardy once put it, this WB drama about a young Clark Kent is basically Dawson's Creek with superpowers. A little catty for Jeopardy, no? At its core, Smallville was a teen drama, and it adhered to that genre's conventions. Love triangles, angst, horniness, scandal, episodes that end with someone staring longingly out of a window while the phrase, "How to Save a Life," plays into the credits. But Smallville was a pretty great teen drama, all things considered, at least for the early seasons. It was also, and still is, the most character-driven take on Superman in any medium. It devoted more time to the psychology of Clark Kent than any movie or comics run. It simply had more time to do so. A good chunk of the series was devoted to Clark flexing his powers on evil or possessed freaks of the week, people granted special abilities from exposure to kryptonite. But Smallville really shined when it focused on Clark's mindset. His anxiety about being an outsider, his guilt about keeping his secret from those he loves, his fear of what might happen if people found out, his struggle to understand his role in the world, his gradual acceptance of the responsibility his power implies. In Smallville, Clark's life is far from perfect. He has power, but does power guarantee happiness? Super strength defeats baddies, but does it defeat anxiety? Does being invulnerable to physical harm mean you have nothing at all to fear? What about the fear of letting down those you love? What about the fear of being alone? What we tried to do, said Smallville's creators Alfred Goff and Miles Miller, is dramatize the emotions of Clark Kent regarding how and why he became a hero. It was an approach that humanized the character far more than any arbitrary reduction in power. It also humanized other figures in the mythos who are just as important as Superman. It's taken for granted that Jonathan and Martha Kent are paragons of decency and good parenting, but Smallville showed us a kindly couple who were often in over their heads. They were raising a super-powered alien, after all. When their son turns to them with confusing, scary changes, they were frequently at a loss. "Dad, what's happening to me?" Clark asks Jonathan after he wakes up floating a few feet above his bed. "I honestly don't know," says Jonathan. "I just wish it would stop." "Look, Clark, I'm your father. I'm supposed to have all the answers. It kills me that I don't. But you got to have faith that we'll figure this thing out together." That's a caring thing to say, but cold comfort for Clark. To my mind, the Kents are the mythos. I don't think you can properly humanize or even really understand Superman without devoting some time to their influence. The more nuanced you make them, the more nuanced Superman will seem. One of the major questions about Superman is, why does he use his extreme power for good? Why is he so selfless when power often has a corrupting effect? With such strength, Clark could have done anything. No one alive can check his power. So when he wants to play high school football and his father says no, why does Clark listen? The corny answer is also the right one. Love. The Kents give Clark what every child needs, human or Kryptonian. They are attentive and kind-hearted, firm yet patient, affectionate and, most important, present. Their presence is the mirror image of the Wayne's absence. If Bruce becomes Batman as an act of vengeance, Clark becomes Superman as a reciprocation of the Kents' love. To love someone is to listen and empathize, to imagine another as complexly as you imagine yourself. Clark trusts that Jonathan and Martha have his best interests at heart because they've spent their lives proving it. To feel that someone really wants to understand and help you is a gift. And once you have it, you can't help but pass it on. Through his immense power, Clark reflects the Kents' love back at the world, a world they made his own. This doesn't mean the relationship is perfect, of course. Love is never without some conflict, especially the love between parent and child. Smallville shows the friction, too, but that only makes the above more persuasive. A realistic portrayal of love, in which all three members of the Kent family are rounded characters, does more to ground the Superman origin than anything else. Smallville devotes more time to this relationship than other versions of the story, and as a result, we get a subtler picture of Superman's motivations and moral center. As a TV show, Smallville was solid, a trailblazing series in some respects, a paint-by-numbers teen drama in others. As a new interpretation of the Superman mythos, I think it's an essential text. With the limitations of comics and movies, you can't expect the same amount of screen or page time devoted to Clark's home life, which is why TV has some of the most humanized takes on the character. For this reason, I have a soft spot for the 90s series Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman. Again, not prestige TV, but as an exploration of Lois and Clark's relationship, it's delightful. As I write this, we're only a few episodes into a new show on the CW called Superman and Lois, in which a married Lois and Clark return to live in Smallville with their twin sons. It's too early to tell how good the series will be, but it looks promising. They've already managed to humanize Clark more than in his three recent film appearances combined, but I'll get to them in a bit. Just because comics have limited space doesn't mean they can't paint a nuanced portrait of Superman's psyche. As a medium of words and pictures, comics is an economical art, like poetry. A lot can be condensed into a page. Consider four panels from one of my favorite Superman comics, Superman for All Seasons. Written by Jeff Loeb and drawn by Tim Sale, this four-part comic is a coming-of-age tale about Clark's departure from home in Smallville and his bumpy debut as Superman. Each installment reflects a season of the year and is told through the perspective of the people around Clark/Superman. The first book, Spring, sees through the eyes of Jonathan Kent as he prepares for his son to leave. The panels say so much about their relationship. Clark towers over his father, lifting a huge boulder as if it were a tennis ball, something it would have taken all afternoon and several tools for Jonathan to do in his prime. As it is, Jonathan is clearly not in his prime, but his son makes the difference irrelevant. Superman is so much stronger, so much more capable than normal humans, that it must be hard not to feel inadequate, even unnecessary, in his presence. In the second panel, Pa Kent looks out to his farm in silence, the farm he spent a lifetime tending with his meager human strength now fading. His son is about to leave the modest home Jonathan and his wife made for him and go out into the world, and perhaps beyond, to fulfill a grand destiny. We know the profound effect the Kents had on Clark, but in this panel, Jonathan seems to doubt it. What can a mortal man teach a god, anyway? Loeb, Sale, and their team do a wonderful job conveying this sense of inadequacy and doubt, mixed with the heartache all parents feel when their child is about to flee the nest. This Superman is anything but boring, and with the emotional groundwork laid, the action scenes hit harder. Superman stories are always going to have a mythic flavor, but that doesn't mean they have to be big all the time. I read dozens of Superman back issues to prepare for this piece from every decade, and in so many of them, Supes is a shell of a character, bouncing from crisis to crisis, never given a moment to reflect. Soon as he solves one fate-of-the-world problem, another lands in his lap. I get it. We read superhero comics for the fireworks. But neglecting the personal makes even the biggest stakes feel empty. Maybe the monthly titles aren't the best place to look for insightful, heartfelt stories. In the 80s and 90s, there were several Superman books running at the same time, each helmed by a different creative team, but constantly crossing over. To finish a story set up in Superman, you'd have to buy Adventures of Superman, where a new writer and artist would pick up from the previous cliffhanger, tell their part, then pass it off to Action Comics, which would do the same. And round it went. For DC, it was a good strategy to force fans to buy more comics. For the making of compelling, self-contained tales, it was less than ideal. This is why you tend to find the best Superman stuff in one-shots, standalone stories like Superman for All Seasons that aren't burdened by the monthly's dense and often bewildering continuity. All the questions I posed above, the questions that exist between the bullet points of the mythos, can be answered with an eye to character. This is what the best Superman narratives have in common. For All Seasons tackles Clark's relationship with the Kents and fleshes out how they serve as an inspiration and refuge for him. When things get difficult for Superman, I usually find it more poignant when he retreats to the Kent farm, or to Lois Lane, rather than to the Fortress of Solitude. But there is plenty to explore in the Fortress, too. In some versions, like Superman the Movie from 1978, the Fortress houses the memories and consciousness of Jor-El, Superman's Kryptonian father. Clark's relationship with Jor-El is more fraught than his relationship with Pa Kent. Whatever else he is, Superman is an immigrant and a child of adoption. It's natural for him to wonder about his origins, as many adopted children seek out their birth parents when they come of age. For Clark, or Kal-El, the moment he learns about his heritage is also the moment he learns he can't return to it, and that his birth parents are dead. Imagine finding a video message from a deceased birth father you never met. It's a bittersweet gift. Maybe there's trauma at the heart of this character, too. There's a touching scene in Superman the Movie between Kal-El, Christopher Reeve, and Jor-El, Marlon Brando, that was cut out of the theatrical version of the film. You can see it in the special edition that was released in 2000. After Superman makes his first appearance in Metropolis, saving Lois Lane, stopping a few crimes, and rescuing Air Force One, he returns to the fortress to tell Jor-El that he enjoyed being the hero, the cheers from the crowds of astonished onlookers. Do not punish yourself for your feelings of vanity, Jor-El says to his son. Simply learn to control them. It is an affliction common to all, even on Krypton. Our destruction could have been avoided but for the vanity of some who considered us indestructible. Were it not for vanity, why, at this very moment, I could embrace you in my arms, my son. Kal-El reaches out his arms as if to return his father's embrace, but quickly catches himself and puts his arms back down, embarrassed. Jor-El's visage fades. Superman the movie isn't perfect, but it's remembered fondly for the performance of Christopher Reeve. The tagline was, "You'll believe a man can fly." But Reeve accomplished more than that. He makes you believe that Superman, the larger-than-life icon, is a man. He's wearing a goofy onesie of primary colors, reaching out to a hologram of his dead father in a crystal fortress. But all I see is the boy who lost his family, stranded in a faraway land among those who look at him with an almost religious awe. Earlier in the film, Jonathan Kent dies from a heart attack when Clark is in his teens. At the funeral, he cries to his mother, "All those things I could do, all those powers, and I couldn't even save him." Later, as Jor-El's image disappears, it dawns on the viewer that Clark has lost two fathers, and his tremendous power only underscores his helplessness. The vulnerability in Reeve's eyes is far more humanizing than kryptonite. What if a villain tried to exploit it, acted as a mentor, earned his trust, then betrayed him at the crucial moment? No, it's just Lex Luthor again trying to blow up the West Coast, or Doomsday punching soups through empty skyscrapers, wreaking empty havoc. My biggest gripe with the recent Superman movies, Man of Steel, Batman v Superman, and Justice League, is that they rarely make use of the character's rich psychology, and what they do use is a bit puzzling. In Man of Steel, for example, Pa is so protective of his son's secret that he suggests Clark may have done the wrong thing by saving his classmates from a bus accident. Later, he refuses to let Clark rescue him from a tornado because it would betray his true self to onlookers. This is the opposite of Jonathan's death in Superman the movie, which shows the limits of Clark's power. In Man of Steel, Clark could have saved his father, but doesn't. If anything is worth revealing yourself, surely it's saving the life of your dad. What's worse, this death doesn't seem to have any psychological bearing on the CGI slugfest that comprises the final hour of the film, in which the solution to defeat the villain is to snap his neck? Listen, I'm open to new interpretations of the mythos. If it makes for a good story, I'll forgive almost anything, even a breaking of the famous rule that Superman does not kill, which wasn't always but is now one of those canonical bullet points. But in Man of Steel, it just feels lazy. So does the death of Superman in Batman v Superman when he sacrifices himself by impaling Doomsday with a kryptonite spear after another CGI slugfest. And as much as I like Superman the movie, the ending where Superman flies around the Earth so fast that he reverses the planet's rotation and turns back time is pretty lazy too, and nonsensical. I don't think any of the live-action Superman movies is a slam dunk. Maybe the demands of blockbuster cinema are to blame. Maybe studios think people will riot if there isn't enough action, so they give audiences their money's worth. These days, that usually involves the above-mentioned slugfests monopolizing the last act of the film. There's nothing wrong with a CGI fight, only a boring CGI fight, and pretty much all of Superman's cinematic bouts are boring. We now have the technology to present the Man of Steel's power in all its glory, but we don't seem to know what to do with it. Supes never does anything clever with his powers. He's just a blunt force object. If all he does is punch really hard again and again and again, slugfests become snoozefests. Hopefully, future filmmakers will figure out how to stage a super brawl that is genuinely thrilling. But I set my hopes higher than that. I would love to see a Superman movie that doesn't rely on mass destruction for a finale. There are other ways to resolve a narrative. What about, and I'm just spitballing here, an ending that relies on wits, not strength? A finale that turns not on Superman's fists, but Lois Lane's pen. Lois and Clark are reporters, supposedly great ones, but that part of their characters is only ever paid lip service in the films. They evoke the cliches about bustling newsrooms and grumpy editors, but actual investigative reporting is absent. That's a shame, especially in the case of Lois, who always gets relegated to Superman's love interest or cheerleader or damsel in distress. The love triangle between Lois, Clark, and Superman is obviously a big part of the mythos, but Lois is so much more than a romantic object. Batman is the world's greatest detective, so he gets to feature in lots of great mystery stories. Why shouldn't Lois Lane, ace reporter for the Daily Planet, get to unravel some mysteries of her own? In 2020, Greg Rucka wrote a 12-issue comic called Lois Lane, Enemy of the People, which gives the character a chance to spread her investigative wings, to define herself apart from Superman. Screenwriters ought to take note. As with the Kents, the more nuanced Lois is, the more compelling the mythos becomes, including the romance. There are things Lois can do that Superman can't. There are things Clark the reporter can do that he can't as a superhero. Superhearing and X-ray vision are useful, if probably illegal, investigative tools, but they won't make a source trust you or sharpen your prose. Superman can save the people of Metropolis from a burning building, but Clark can expose the contractors who cut costs by using cheap, flammable cladding, and the city officials who line their pockets by looking the other way. To paraphrase Lois from Enemy of the People, Superman can thwart the hammer of evil, but Lois and Clark can go after the arm swinging it and the system that grants it freedom of motion. The powers that influence the world are not always physical. In those spheres, as in the spheres of psychology and relationships, Superman is as powerful and powerless as anyone. In fact, his physical perfection makes him the ideal character to explore these parts of human nature. In him, the non-physical is thrown into the starkest possible relief. A great Superman story shouldn't turn on what physical might can do, but all it can't. Which brings me back, finally, to Bill. He seems to believe that Clark Kent is a God's interpretation of human beings. Weak, unsure of himself, a coward. This, he says, is how Superman views our species. It's true that the Clark who works at the Daily Planet, who stumbles and stutters and can't open a soda bottle for Perry White, is partly an act. How else is he going to fool a room of Pulitzer winners? But so is Superman, the icon, the symbol, the embodiment of virtue. These are dual roles. When Clark wakes up in the morning, he's neither the symbol nor the secret identity. He's the boy who grew up in Smallville, the son of Jonathan and Martha, the friend and colleague and sometimes husband of Lois Lane, a journalist for a great metropolitan newspaper, an immigrant, a child of adoption who yearns for a family he never met, a person who accepts the responsibility his power implies, who tries to reciprocate the love he received to the world that took him in. Clark Kent is not a critique of the human race. He is part of the human race. In all the ways that matter, including and especially his weaknesses, He is human. He's one of us. As he says in Lois and Clark, Superman is what I can do. Clark is who I am. Yes, I know. I just spent 6,000 words refuting one fictional character's argument about another fictional character. I should probably go outside. In Tarantino's defense, he may have written Bill's take on Superman to be wrong. He's the villain, after all. Wrong is what villains tend to be, especially about heroes. Bill gives his little spiel about Superman as a way to convince Beatrix Kiddo, the hero, aka the bride, that her attempt at domestic life was always doomed to fail. You would have worn the costume of Arlene Plimpton, Bill tells her, but you were born Beatrix Kiddo, and every morning when you woke up, you'd still be Beatrix Kiddo. At heart, he says, she's a killer. Bill sees Beatrix with a villain's lack of imagination. Too often, we make the same mistake with Clark Kent. Jerry Seinfeld's Intangibles. Jerry Seinfeld walks into a room of advertising professionals. It's 2014. He's receiving an honorary Clio Award for pushing the boundaries of creativity and his long-standing contributions to the field. The ad people don't know it yet, but Seinfeld is about to give one of the most biting acceptance speeches in awards show history. He opens up with a few thank yous, then, I love advertising because I love lying. In advertising, everything is the way you wish it was. I don't care that it won't be like that when I actually get the product being advertised, because in between seeing the commercial and owning the thing, I'm happy, and that's all I want. We know the product is going to stink. We know that. But we are happy in that moment between the commercial and the purchase. And I think spending your life trying to dupe innocent people out of hard-won earnings to buy useless, low-quality, misrepresented items and services is an excellent use of your energy. The last line got a hollering round of applause. I'm not exactly sure why. It may have been an involuntary, nervous response. It may be that they agreed with him. It was an excellent use of their energy to dupe innocent people out of hard-won earnings. Or maybe it was just relieving to hear someone not bullshit them. They work in an industry that operates on bullshit, after all. Then they're asked to swallow the self-important bullshit of an award ceremony? Maybe it was nice to hear a comedian slice through that. Watching the speech, you can see Seinfeld revels in satirizing this event and roasting its attendees. What do you expect? This is someone who made a career of mocking the vacuousness of everyday life. Could anything be more vacuous than an award show for advertising in which he was receiving an honorary prize? This is the award they give you when they don't think you can actually win one, he points out. Despite that, despite its meaninglessness, Seinfeld is happy with the award in the same way he's happy with a shoddy product in that moment between the commercial and the purchase. It's a happiness as stupid as the award, as the event, as advertising, and it will last until I get to the edge of this stage when it hits me that this was all a bunch of nonsense. It's a funny speech, delivered in that signature high-pitched lilt that makes even caustic remarks sound good-natured. And they are caustic, as much of Seinfeld's comedy is. As he said many times, the source of all those observational bits is irritation. If you are not easily irritated, it is hard to be funny. But Seinfeld's not irritated by his irritability. He knows it's a golden comedy goose, and if it makes normal socializing a struggle, if it strains relationships at times, you just have to take the good with the bad. I've got a pretty good hand of cards here, he says of himself. I'll take the bad along with it. It comes as a set. You don't get to pick what you want. This is Jerry Seinfeld's characteristic point of view. You hear it in his comedy, in interviews, in the Clio acceptance speech. He's an incisive critic of society, human behavior, and himself, but most of the time his criticisms don't encourage change, but acceptance. We're used to hearing opinionated people on Twitter, on TV, at Thanksgiving, on stand-up stages, come down on their side of an argument with righteous force. Seinfeld's opinions have force, but little righteousness. Or rather, he locates his righteousness in a different place than most people. Civilization is absurd and hypocritical because people are, he implies, and both will remain so forevermore. Enjoy the good, laugh at the bad, accept that it comes as a set. Despite his reputation as a comic who jokes about nothing, Seinfeld is often as philosophical as his deeper peers. It's just that his worldview is more implicit than, say, George Carlin's, who embarked on long, hilarious polemics about religion and censorship and American hypocrisy. Carlin is the forefather of a dominant mode in today's comedy, an enlightened, speaking truth to power, almost journalistic style. Jon Stewart took the mantle from Carlin, then passed it down to his mentees, Stephen Colbert, John Oliver, Trevor Noah, Samantha Bee, Hasan Minhaj, Larry Wilmore, who went on to conquer late-night television in the U.S. I'm a fan of all these comics. They've produced hours of razor-sharp material, which is hysterical and informative without sacrificing one for the other. But this is not Seinfeld's lane. He's not a message comic. He avoids politics and never even approaches an activistic tone. Can you imagine Seinfeld doing a bit on private prisons? I can't even imagine him saying the words. To some extent, this apoliticism puts him at odds with the current trend, which reflects a renewed culture of activism in the general public. On Last Week Tonight, John Oliver will do 20 minutes on private prisons, and you'll come out of it with knowledge about a topical issue and maybe even some motivation to push for change. You won't learn much from a Seinfeld set, not about anything more important than Pop-Tarts, anyway. And you definitely won't feel motivated to join a protest or open your wallet for a cause. And that's fine. Comedians aren't obligated to educate or talk about important subjects or provoke self-reflection. All they have to do is make you laugh. They can achieve that by dissecting political hypocrisy or sledgehammering watermelons. Seinfeld may not be an activist, but he does turn a critical eye on our society, and what he sees there is often as damning as anything John Oliver describes, and sometimes more subtle. The Clio speech is a good example of this. Seinfeld strikes at the essence of advertising, which may be a creative and clever craft, but is exploitative at heart. Ads pull whatever emotional strings they can to prompt a purchase. They manipulate us in gross ways to generate desire, to make us feel need where it doesn't exist. And as Seinfeld points out, much of advertising is really false advertising, exaggeration and truth stretching, using glue instead of milk so a bowl of cereal will look more appealing. In ridiculing advertising, Seinfeld indicts our warped culture of materialism, in which we're made to feel less than for not having as much crap as our neighbors and friends. Maybe indict is too strong a word. Seinfeld removes the gilding from a self-important event like the Clio's. He helps us to see an unpleasant truth about our society, but he doesn't go further than that. Instead, he suggests that there's something to cherish in the perverted relationship we have with advertising. The small period of joy between the purchase and getting the crappy product. A brief moment of happiness is pretty good, he says. I also think that just focusing on making money and buying stupid things is a good way of life. I believe materialism gets a bad rap. If your things don't make you happy, you're not getting the right things. Obviously, Jerry's being sarcastic. But is he really? I get the sense he wants it both ways. Advertising, and by extension, capitalism, only offers us a superficial happiness. And maybe that's not the most we could hope for, but it's not bad either. Superficial joys are still joys, after all. They're pretty good, and pretty good is good enough. There's something strangely freeing about this perspective. We know consumerism and materialism are bad things. They're words that are only ever used in a pejorative way. We know that a system that encourages the acquisition of more and more stuff, in which advertising plays an essential role, negatively affects the environment and creates all kinds of inequities and incentives to exploit others. We know this. We know it, and we decry it at every opportunity. We decry it on our $1,000 iPhones, in our new cars, at our homes decorated with all manner of junk, like that Argali rug from West Elm that really ties the room together. We are all hopelessly entangled in the system we criticize. That's a feature of global capitalism, the implication of everyone in a great number of morally messy activities. It can make you feel bewildered, impotent, guilty, apathetic, most of all, hypocritical. This constellation of feelings, this forced cognitive dissonance, is what Seinfeld excels at articulating. In his marvelous bit on garbage, for example, Seinfeld envisions the bizarre world consumerism creates and the bizarre people it makes us into. The premise is more lucid and concise than most anti-capitalist manifestos. All things on Earth only exist in different stages of becoming garbage. Your home is a garbage processing center, where you buy new things, bring them into your house, and slowly crapify them over time. All our stuff, Seinfeld says, is garbage in waiting, decaying even before we buy it. In some ways, this is literally true. One upshot of a booming consumer culture is the practice of planned obsolescence, a policy of producing goods that rapidly become obsolete and require replacing. And if our things don't become functionally obsolete, they become fashionably obsolete. We are continuously encouraged, via advertising, to get the latest and greatest, lest we be left behind. As industrial designer Brooke Stevens put it, this approach should instill in the buyer the desire to own something a little newer, a little better, a little sooner than is necessary. What does that say about the value of our things? For much of what we own, its fate as trash is a foregone conclusion, and the houses where we keep it all begin to take on a weird aspect. They begin to look like garbage processing centers. Seinfeld goes on to describe the journey of garbage through the processing centers we insist on calling home. Objects start on the kitchen table, the place of honor for the new arrival, before being demoted to a cupboard, then a closet, then a garage. No object has ever made it out of the garage and back into the house, he says. The word garage seems to be a form of the word garbage. You can just picture your own garage, can't you? That pile of crap that's been slowly eroding the parking space since the late 90s. As the years pass and we get struck by this or that fleeting enthusiasm, we accumulate mountains of garbage. We can't bear to reflect on our compulsive buying habits, often a coping mechanism for deeper issues, so we hide our trash in places where we can't see it. Drawers, cupboards, the basement, the garage. Seinfeld points this out without being didactic or denigrating. The critique is concealed within the laughs. The only thing that can save our hidden garbage from the landfill, he adds, is eBay. Why don't we mail our garbage back and forth to each other? Now, the world is a garbage processing center, and we're the workers who transfer the trash from one place to the next. In Seinfeld's surreal vision, humans are subordinate to their things. We do their bidding, literally. Like the best satire, it rings true, which is why we wince a little. Some of what he says is barely an exaggeration, like his description of storage units. Now, instead of free garbage, you pay rent to visit your garbage. It is perverse, but that's the world of mass consumerism, which needs us to develop a ravenous love affair with stuff to perpetuate itself. By shifting the viewpoint, Seinfeld helps us to see this more clearly. Again, he's not prescriptive, just descriptive. But what a description it is. Jon Stewart once said of Seinfeld, "He is able to comedically articulate an intangible for people. When they see it, they go, 'God, that's been in my head, and I know it's been in there, but I've never put it together with that kind of rhythm in four levels, and that's hilarious.'" As I said in my essay about Emerson, articulation is a form of magic to me, and I'm drawn to those who can do it well. Fundamentally, there is no difference between what Seinfeld does and what Emerson does. They both articulate the world. They help us to see reality with fresh eyes. Their ends may be different. For Emerson, it's to spark reflection. For Seinfeld, laughter. But their toolbox is the same. And comedians, more than essayists and other writers, task themselves with interpreting the world from unusual angles. Everything is suspect to them, open to radical readings, from the most profound to the most mundane. In his Netflix special, Jerry Before Seinfeld, Seinfeld talks about encountering Mad Magazine as a kid. You start reading it, and you're going, "Well, these people don't respect anything," and that just exploded my head. You don't have to buy it. You could say, "That's stupid. This," gesturing to the world, "is stupid." The it that you didn't have to buy was conventional wisdom, the generally accepted assumptions that attach themselves to all we do. For comics, conventional wisdom is the enemy, and they're ruthless in pulling it apart. Sentence for sentence, minute for minute, stand-up comedians produce a greater number of revelatory experiences for people than other articulators. This is why we feel a strong connection to our favorites. Sometimes a laugh is the recognition of what you always believed but couldn't put into words, like Stewart describes. Other times it's shock at a startlingly true idea or point of view you never thought about before. Still other times, it's the realization that your perspective is flawed or polluted by conventional wisdom. These are moving experiences in their own right, but they're made more so by the fact that laughing is so pleasurable. A laugh is an emotional and physical experience, which all but ensures that the big ones will stick in your memory. No disrespect to Emerson, but don't expect belly laughs from his essays. This is the advantage comedians have over other interpreters of experience. Absolutely everyone is looking for a laugh, so they have the potential to reach an enormous segment of the population. This is also their great challenge. Bits must be coherent. There's no wiggle room on this. If a paragraph of writing is a little confusing, you can reread it. If a joke is confusing, the joke fails. Live comedy must be perfectly intelligible to a diverse audience the first time around, which means that the best comics are master communicators, in addition to being funny. On both qualities, the comedy going public is merciless. If a comedian isn't funny and lucid, they'll be weeded out. As Seinfeld says, no one is more judged in civilized society than a stand-up comedian. Every 12 seconds, you're rated. Those who pass the test are rewarded with a unique and powerful bond with fans. Seinfeld articulates intangibles through the lens of the trivial. By recounting the life cycle of a piece of garbage, he reframes our role in the consumer economy. By describing the experience of eating at a buffet, Seinfeld holds up a mirror to a society that invites overconsumption and the human psyche that can't resist it. Nobody would go into a restaurant, say to the waiter, "I want a yogurt parfait, spare ribs, a waffle, 4 cookies, and an egg white omelet." People build these death row last meal wish lists. It's like a working model of all their emotional issues and personal needs. Like shopping, eating is often a coping mechanism, and the buffet exploits that. Entering these debauched Caligula food orgies, the veneer of self-control vanishes, and our gluttonous nature is revealed. But we've normalized buffets so successfully that we don't register the absurdity. Seinfeld registers it. So much of culture looks absurd and farcical and dumb to him. Very little of what he sees seems reasonable, but everyone's acting like it is. He's like a child looking at the irrational adult world, asking a million questions, but all the adults can say is, "That's just the way it is." Most people grow up and become those adults. Seinfeld grew up, but retained a child's inquisitiveness and a child's impatience with the moronic and the dull. Maybe this is why a lot of his stand-up is told from the perspective of himself as a kid. In his first special, Stand-Up Confidential, from 1987, Seinfeld even inserts film skits of his childhood, seen through the lens of comedy X-ray specs that lets the general public be exposed to the way comedians view our world. Seinfeld plays himself as a 6-year-old, towered over by his parents and their friends, who are fitted with bodysuits to exaggerate the perspective. Young Jerry dances around but can't get the attention of the adults, who launch platitudes at one another. The inanity of their clichés reflects the inanity Seinfeld sees throughout the adult world. As a kid, he watched his mother spend hours in the wallpaper store flipping through giant books of patterns. "It was like the Quran," he says, mimicking her zeal. "She was looking at the patterns. Yes, I understand what they're saying." It's a funny and relatable memory that smuggles a critique of suburban middle-class values. Mrs. Seinfeld treated wallpaper as a religion, like millions of Americans still do with their home decor. If it's not wallpaper, it's clothes or gadgets or food or cars. It's well known that Seinfeld cherishes cars with the same reverence his mom cherished wallpaper. On balance, these things play a larger role in our lives than traditional religion does, and have for decades. They're what we turn to for meaning and comfort and fulfillment. As a kid, Jerry could see that in his mother's eyes. I don't think Seinfeld aims to impart profound critiques with his comedy. In fact, I'd bet he'd scoff at the suggestion. What he cares about most is laughs, and there are plenty of ways to get them that don't involve deep insights. Much of what appears to be insightful, he admits, is just comedic sleight of hand. At a recent New York Times event, he said, "A lot of comedy sounds like you're driving to a point of logic or perspective, and you're really just setting up a joke. It's a technique." A good example of this is his donut hole bit, which has a philosophical feeling to it. "A hole does not exist. Words have meanings. A hole is the absence of whatever is surrounding it. If they were really donut holes, the bag would be empty." But is really just clever wordplay. There's no deeper meaning to this joke. It's just silly, and that's fine. Seinfeld doesn't differentiate between bits that have meaning and bits that don't. Laughs are the only vital criteria. "I never put anything above the laugh," he told Marc Maron on his WTF podcast in 2020. "Self-revelation, opinion, insight, all these things, I'd never weigh those more than a laugh." but occasionally they intertwine, responded Marin. If they want to, I don't worry about that part. The conversation between Marin and Seinfeld is illuminating. Marin spends the better part of an hour trying to understand why Seinfeld doesn't reveal more of himself in his comedy. For Marin, insight and self-revelation are vital parts of stand-up. I got into it for the pursuit of a certain personal truth, he says. Comedy is a way to share the truth and disarm big ideas that were threatening. It's how you become who you are. It's deep, man. If Oliver represents message comedy, Marin represents what you might call confessional comedy, another dominant mode of the current era. Confessional comics bare their souls on stage, using the format to analyze their fears and flaws in funny ways. The forefather of this style is Richard Pryor, who spoke with remarkable candor about his drug addiction, failed marriages, experiences with racism, and more. Seinfeld called him the Picasso of our profession. Like Picasso, Pryor changed the medium, influencing generations of artists who came after. Chris Rock, Bill Hicks, Sarah Silverman, Gerard Carmichael, Doug Stanhope, Kevin Hart, Mike Birbiglia, the list goes on. I'm a fan of this style, too. The fearlessness of these comics, their readiness to be vulnerable, has made for some breathtaking and breathtakingly funny work. Confessional comics are not above silly laughs, but as Marin says, they use comedy to pursue emotional truth. This is not Seinfeld's lane, either. But that doesn't mean truth is absent from his material. I actually think Seinfeld is being a bit disingenuous when he's blasé about a joke's relationship to insight. Yes, he has some nonsensical bits, jokes built out of witty wordplay, but most of his material springs from a careful scrutiny of life. By prioritizing the laugh, the biggest laugh from the largest number of people, he's actually prioritizing the most universal truths. That requires a lot of self-examination, even if the jokes don't call attention to it. There is proper acclaim, the comedian John Mulaney says, given to confessional, self-revelatory, sometimes dark writing, performing, or stand-up. But there are things people ignore in observational humor or jokes that seem small where you go, that's that whole person right there. Mulaney is a brilliant comic whom people often compare to Seinfeld. He also works in the observational mode, with a little more willingness to mine his personal life for material. There are jokes that seem just like an innocuous